Welcome to the second Superdelegate Q&A. Coming at you just a little bit late, but you will get your content. It may come late, but you will get it. And I'll say it a third time if I have to. You will get your content. It will be late, and you will take what you are fed. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, sorry, folks. If someone's going to take the blame for this, it should probably be me. But we're here. We got the questions in front of us. This is only the second one of these we've done. So, Will, I'm ready if you are. Let's go.
So Victor asks, in honor of this year's International Bob Dylan Day, which I have to admit, I did not know was a thing, but every day is Bob Dylan Day at my house. But I think that's great that it's been institutionalized. Victor asks, what are your top three favorite Bob Dylan songs and how did you become a fan? What do you think, Luke? What are your, cause I'll start with number one with a bullet, Like a Rolling Stone. One of those ones where, sorry that it's a cliche answer, but when you hear those first notes, you know, da, 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 you know, you hear it and you hear the range of sound packed into that note. You just think, oh fuck. Yeah. That's what it's all about. What do you think, Luke? I'll give you two more later.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't really. There's so many Bob Dylan songs. It's hard to say top three. I mean, I'll say three off the top of my head that I'm particularly fond of. I mean, It's All Right Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, I think is pretty incredible. Most of the Time from Oh Mercy, a later track. Actually, I'll give you another later one I really like, and that's Mississippi from Love and Theft. Are those actually my three favorite Bob Dylan songs? I don't know. It would take me like hours in the lab to determine. But how did I become a fan of Dylan? I mean, I don't have like a, there wasn't like a Road to Damascus conversion or anything. I didn't like fall off a donkey and then like see a copy of Bringing It All Back Home on the ground. I think for me, discovering Dylan as a teenager, there was just like a sophistication in the songwriting that, you know, I just didn't see in the other things that people in my high school in, you know, grade 9 and 10 were listening to. So, I don't know, I took to him very naturally.
Man, I was going to do Most of the Time for my number two. You know, I thought it was going to be a really clever deep cut. But listen, we all know Mr. Tambourine Man, you know, Desolation Road, whatever. But for some deeper cut ones, I'll say Not Dark Yet from Time Out of Mind and Ain't Talkin' from Modern Times are two later ones I really like. And yeah, Modern Times was actually the one that kind of got me. I got that from my parents as a Christmas present in high school and played a lot. Really enjoyed that.
So Mert Pie, this is a question for me, Luke, in your opinion, how realistically worried should we be about Project 2025? Now, for those who don't know, Project 2025, I mean, I don't have to call it hypothetical because it, you know, it has been drawn up in some fashion, but basically it will nominally form part of Trump's transition agenda if he wins the second term. And basically the idea is to like purge the deep state. That's the billing. So to reshape the presidency and to kind of stack the federal civil service with Trump loyalists. Basically, you know, make the president a more powerful figure and, you know, kind of consolidate Trumpism. So how worried should we be about this? I mean, I don't think there's any denying, right, that there are authoritarian impulses at the core of Trumpism. Although what I would say about this is anytime anyone around Donald Trump draws up like a detailed plan for anything, my sense of their ability to actually carry out a plan at the level of detail, you know, it's harder for me to see something like this, you know, being carried out at the level of detail. I mean, in 2015 and 2016, and you know, shortly after Trump's first inauguration, I was genuinely worried, and I think a lot of people were worried, that this was going to be a type of presidency we'd never seen before. And there was a flurry of executive orders Trump did, but within a few months, really, it became clear that the kind of Steve Bannon vision for a Trump presidency wasn't really on. I mean, the Trumpists, despite being in some ways quite ideologically motivated, were just very disorganized. And so Trump very quickly became just a, you know, in many ways, you know, notwithstanding his bizarre personal conduct and the way he speaks and such, he became a sort of, in legislative terms, a fairly conventional right-wing Republican president. So I should probably study more, you know, study Project 2025 in a little more detail, but that would be my provisional answer to the question now.
I suppose it sounds like somebody should be about as worried as if any Republican president gets in office and is making appointments.
There is a longstanding, I mean, I think that the resistance, if you want, has really, I mean, they have been so dogmatic about the idea that Donald Trump is this singular kind of figure. And I've never really seen it in those terms. I think that there's plenty of states where the state state-level Republicans have not needed a Donald Trump to obscenely gerrymander the electoral map or, like, stack the court or, you know, just try to overcome every barrier to absolute power. And so I agree with your assessment, Will.
Dave asks, question for Will, but Luke is welcome to answer. Are you a fan of the films of Gaspar Noé? And if yes, are there any you find particularly noteworthy or interesting? Gaspar Noé is a French provocateur strongly associated with the new French extremity movement, Enter the Void, Irreversible, Vortex, Climax. I am generally in favor, cautiously in favor of Gaspar Noé. You know, there's very little beneath the surface in his movies, but the surface is often quite dynamic, and he is an entertainer. And I would also say I Stand Alone, his first movie, is probably my favorite of his films. It's kind of like a more extreme version of Taxi Driver, and I think it really packs a punch. So yeah, broadly in favor.
So Corey wants to know, why doesn't the show end with Now Watch This Drive anymore? When the music starts playing without it, I'm expecting there to be more show. Well, we do sometimes end with Now Watch This Drive. I don't know. What do you think, Will? I have a feeling that this isn't something we've even, like, consciously done. It's fun to drop it in now and again, but I think doing it every episode might feel a little gimmicky. I don't know.
Well, it would be gimmicky, but I don't necessarily know if that's a reason not to do it. I think the reason why we don't do it every episode anymore is because sometimes we'll want to end the episode on a different sort of note. Sometimes there will be a sort of flourish that we don't necessarily want to undercut with, like, a silly joke. Other times, it's perfectly fine to undercut whatever
we're
said.
Other times we're at a total loss, and it actually saves us a lot of work coming up with a good riff for the end.
So Jackson asks, any New Year's resolutions, goals, or noteworthy plans you're willing to share? For me, I would like to work on some sort of longer form writing project. You know, something book or book adjacent. And, you know, I've been saying this for years. I have a Prince-like vault full of uncompleted projects, and hopefully one of them will muscle its way out, maybe this year or the next. I'd like to put in some solid work into sort of like a book or monograph length argument about something.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically was going to be mine. I mean, I'd like to write another book this year. Hopefully that'll happen. I guess, like, a less exciting goal I have is just to get into the same shape I was before the pandemic hit. I don't know if I've talked about this, but some way into the pandemic, I was going to, like, obscene lengths to, you know, maintain my lean mass and, like, do cardio and stuff like that. And I remember there was this one day, I guess it must have been the winter of 2021, where I was trying to do jump rope in the parking lot outside my building. Like, I was doing all these, like, body weight, like, prison workouts, basically, in my apartment, which, like, you know, you've been there many times. It's not like a huge space. It's not super easy to do that. And then, like, I was doing jump rope in the parking lot, which was, like, completely frozen over, and I was just freezing, and I kept almost slipping, and I was just like, okay, I give up. I've been, like, going nuts, like, to try to maintain this level of physical fitness for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months now, and I just have to surrender myself to the reality that this is, like, a time in history that none of us expected, and maybe I can't remain in as good shape. So I've made some gains back, but yeah, I'm hoping to get down to being as lean and strong as I was kind of in 2020 and early 2021.
Well, actually, this is hitting at another one of my goals, because I'm working on getting back to my pre-pandemic weight, but my fitness regimen will be simpler than Luke's. I'm simply cutting out all the bad food and counting calories. So I'm proud to say I am down 10 pounds, and we're looking at getting another 10 off by the time this experiment is over.
Saber, but the shitty hockey team, says, if you ever obtain a tour bus, would you be willing to refer to it as the Michelin bus? I guess Saber's real name
no.
is Ian.
Absolutely not.
I like that idea. And Mert Pye adds, if the director of Good Will Hunting becomes a permanent third Mike, would it then be Michael and Gus? Why not?
I think if Gus Van Sant is interested in the show, I think we'll test him out as, like, a guest first. And if he works in that slot, we could trip. But, you know, like, he'll have to work at our schedule. I also just want to address the first comment, which is that somebody needs to offer us a lot of money for a tour, and then we can talk about what the bus is called. Mr. Dalliard says, Let's say the socialist revolution happens, capitalism and eventually money are abolished, and the state withers away. What would cinema and TV become or even look like in a post-capitalist world? Well, I would refer to the wisdom of the great Mort Rifkin and note that even if all of our political problems are solved, we would still be faced with the truly big questions, which are, is there a God? Why are we here?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say something along those lines as well. I mean, a part of me is tempted to engage with the sort of initial premise of the question about, you know, in a world where there's kind of no scarcity and there's some kind of mass socialization has occurred of the economy, et cetera, does that mean the state withers away and, you know, money's abolished in a kind of classically Marxist sense. But I'm not going to engage with that part of it because it's too complicated to get into. Yeah, I would answer in much the same way that Will did. I mean, if folks will remember one of the episodes we did on Ingmar Bergman some time ago now, I kind of advanced the thesis that one of the ways to understand Bergman's work is that, you know, it kind of is the product of a society which probably almost certainly the most egalitarian society to ever exist. And yet, Bergman is not, you know, he's not lacking for material. No, he's thinking about mortality and, yeah, the nature of reality and the human condition and that kind of thing. Yeah, I just think a world where all of us had our basic needs met and were liberated from the kind of oppression that is, you know, so intrinsic to capitalist society, you know, class hierarchy and other things. All that would mean to me, I think, is that culture might be less preoccupied with kind of imminent material suffering, but that doesn't mean there wouldn't be material for filmmakers to explore, or musicians, or anything else.
There would still be romantic longing, which is the inspiration and subject of probably 90% of art. So you can look forward to more of that. But maybe there will be a future where someone will look on the screen and say, "Daddy, what is a little tramp?" That doesn't make sense, but we'll see. Shane asks, curious of the boys' preferred Redford and Newman pairing, The Sting or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Well, I have to admit, I've seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but I was much younger at the time, and I have never seen The Sting. But I am in favor, broadly, of Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I don't know if you've seen those movies, Luke.
I'm embarrassed. Classic
Americana, you know.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't, and I'll tell you, I'm gonna debase myself even more here by admitting on Mike that I've also never seen Once Upon a Time in the West. So future episodes for us.
Now that's a movie. Shane also asks if we consider the gambling movie a true genre, like one would a Western. He gobbles them up like Westerns. I say sure. I mean, if you identify like a body of films that has sort of a consistent set of tropes, and more importantly, you know, you seek out those movies and like them, I would say that constitutes a genre, or a micro genre at least. Sure.
Everyone should watch Croupier. That's my opinion. It's a good-ass movie.
I would recommend The Gambler by Carol Reese, starring James Caan.
So James says, I think I missed the last call for questions, so I'll just repost my last one. Hey, Luke and Will, to pin you two as the film guy and politics guy, respectively, I wanted to remark upon my relief when hearing Luke's unreserved enthusiasm for recently reassessed films like Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and Showgirls. Given the received wisdom about these and other film maudits, what are the benefits and drawbacks of the critical backgrounds that afflict these films? There are great critics like Rosenbaum and Hoberman who have done monumental efforts to resuscitate unfairly maligned things, but have the middlebrow critical class created a barrier between the above works and their greater accessibility. Also, I wanted to ask about the also-rans from previous superdelegate votes, Warrendale, ECW, some others. Is there still a plan to cover these in the future? Tentatively, yes. I mean, I can't give you a timeline, but those have been suggested so many times. I'm sure we'll do them. They're on the list.
We've promised. We'll do them. That's an interesting question, though. I mean, there are a lot of factors that lead to a critically maligned film being critically maligned in the first place and then being resuscitated, you know, just like any art form. Certain influential critics and programmers getting behind them and giving audiences a sort of lens through which to see something. I mean, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me happened to come out around a time when David Lynch was maybe getting a little overexposed, or I don't know, there's something that often happens to artists in mid-career when if they they've been so praised, people sometimes get a feeling of buyer's remorse. But I don't get a strong sense that the initial critical reception to those movies has created a huge barrier between them and great accessibility. In as much as that barrier has taken place, it's been chipped away at by the zeitgeist. I would say both of those movies probably do play better now than they played when they came out because of certain shifts that have happened in culture. You know, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me probably plays just a little bit better when it's not in the immediate wake of the cancellation of the TV show and when it's come out in a time of heightened discourse about sexual violence. Showgirls, too, I would imagine perhaps its jaundiced outsider's take on America probably takes place a little bit better now in our slightly disillusioned time than it did in the 90s. So anyway, I would say, you know, obviously there were people who were ahead of the curve on both these movies, but movies don't exist in a vacuum. No art exists in a vacuum, and they're constantly adapting and showing different sorts of colors and textures based on the world around them.
The only thing I'll throw in here, even though it's kind of outside the, you know, parameters of James' question, is it's amusing to think that the reverse process has also occurred, where like something that was celebrated is actually, you know, falls out of favor, which is, you know, just really just the same phenomenon in reverse. And here I'm thinking specifically of the film Forrest Gump, probably for me one of, you know, a Michael and Us all-timer. And, you know, I was really amused when we were doing background reading on that film. There was a section on Wikipedia for that movie that I don't think I've ever seen for anything before, and it was like subsequent reevaluation. It's just all about how people gradually realizing that actually Forrest Gump is revanchist and horrible.
So Matt says, more of a plug than a question, but have either of you had much experience with Argentine cinema? So I'm just going to say right now, not a huge amount of experience aside from, like, you know, really famous ones. Like, I don't know, I saw The Secret in Their Eyes when it won the Foreign Film Oscar. I'm working my way around the globe. I promise I'll get there.
Yeah, I don't know much about Argentine cinema either, Matt. There's no good reason for that. I see you've left us some kind of suggestions here, and appreciate this. I mean, we really should excavate it at some point, and we will. We'll take note of all the films that that you mention here. Moving on, Michael says, hey gang, I've always enjoyed your article and book suggestions. Do you have any suggestions for nonfiction books outside of your areas of interest, i.e. Western, Anglophone, cinema, and politics? For example, a biography, self-help book, study in architecture, visual art, literature, sport, food, history. Thanks for great shows every week. All the best. Mike, what do you think, Will?
I imagine that this question is probably positioned to us as, you know, the film guy and the politics guy. But I would say that we probably do have, you know, broader interests than just that, and we are reading about things that aren't just those subjects. I mean, you mentioned biography, or, you know, art books or literature. I mean, yeah, it's Christ. I mean, there are just so many that I like. I was just reading Osita Wunevu's article about Tom Wolfe, because there's a new documentary out about Tom Wolfe. And he did a very interesting analysis of Wolfe as, you know, a conservative writer. And I'm not recommending Tom Wolfe right now, but at various times in my life, I've sort of fallen in and out of love with the new journalists who emerged in the 60s and 70s. You know, those journalists who sort of turned journalism into an art form, quote unquote. If you're being really ungenerous, you could say that they sort of gentrified it from being a working class profession into something that, you know, the Ivy League took an interest in. But nevertheless, I mean, off the top of my head, I would really recommend any collection of Gay Talese's writing. That's the sort of thing that I would pick off the shelf if I were looking for just something pleasurable to read.
I mean, I guess I've talked about my love of literature on the show many times, but there's a lot of poetry that I like. Still very fond of E.E. Cummings, who I discovered as a teenager. Actually, E.E. Cummings wrote a novel that I feel like people don't really know about called The Enormous Room. That's a sort of satirical novel based on his experiences during the First World War. That's just a random thing that I pulled off the top of my head. But I guess Michael also mentioned visual art. So I will say that the book version of the TV series, Robert Hughes TV series, Shock of the New, means a great deal to me. And I mean, you can watch a lot of those episodes on YouTube. And the book is kind of just a transcription of the monologue, but it has all of the images. It has all the paintings, the sculptures, everything. So I find that's a really useful way to consume the show, because if you're watching it, something will just be on the screen for a few seconds. You don't really have time to study it. And I found the book, like, for actually really thinking about the art that the series discusses, the book was sort of the go-to for me. Moving on, Elise asks, I always enjoy your take on childhood films like the recent Mouse Hunt episode, but I've also been wondering a bit about whether adults can properly review children's films or TV. I think you both do a good job of acknowledging the disconnect between what worked for you as a kid and why it doesn't have the same resonance now, as much an age shift as a cultural shift. But where does that leave adults trying to critically evaluate children's cultural products? I mean, you know, this is an interesting question. I will say that when we watch a film like Mouse Hunt, you know, we might comment on whether we find it entertaining or don't find it entertaining as adults. But I mean, our goal isn't to exactly do like a conventional critical evaluation. I think maybe if I had children, I would be able to think a little more clearly about whether a film, you know, a children's film was good for children or not. But I mean, part of the exercise for me in watching something like Mouse Hunt and discussing it on the show, absolutely inherent in it is just kind of the absurdity of like us, you know, watching Mouse Hunt and like talking about it. So I don't really know how to answer this.
Well, I remember what it was like to be a child. I had, you know, pretty indiscriminate taste as a child. So, but you know, I went to see The Wizard of Oz this weekend, playing in a theater here in Toronto. Had a great experience. Just a great crowd that was full of a mix of film Twitter people and families and hipsters and old guard Toronto cinephiles and kids. Just all united at this movie. And there were certain moments in The Wizard of Oz that it's kind of like I know it when I see it. Like, I know that this movie at certain moments is really tapping into something very primal that would affect the child, because like I can feel it even as an adult. Like the whole movie, Dorothy, you know, is trying to get home and, you know, she's lost and she's worried Auntie Em is worried about her. And that's a very primal feeling. And there's a scene where she's trapped in the witch's castle and the crystal ball shows Auntie Em in Kansas going, Dorothy, where are you? Where are you, Dorothy? And Dorothy's like crying, saying, I'm here, Auntie Em, I'm here. And then the aunt fades into the Wicked Witch, laughing at her, making fun of her for crying. And I thought, oh my God, that is a demonic image. Even now, like 85 years after it came out, you know, I just know from having been a child how powerful that would be to a child. So I don't know, there are certain feelings that I think I still have access to.
Yeah, I would second that. And I'd also add that there are sometimes things we've watched and discussed on this show that I knew very well as a child, but watching them again as an adult, I realized how many of the jokes often went completely over my head as a child. I miss certain subtleties. I do think as a child, because by definition, you're sort of experiencing things for the first time. And this you know, extends far beyond just consuming movies and TV. It's really everything. I do think there's a kind of a purity of experience and an innocence of experience that you can't really recapture. And I do think that, you know, there's no getting around it. The kids have got us beat there.
So one last question from Alexander. My question is for Luke, but Will can also chime in if he is considering cinema TikTok. Why aren't you on TikTok, Luke? TikTok is at the front lines of political ideology right now. So Alex continues, and listen, we all hear about TikTok. It's poisoning our children. It's turning them against the country. China is using it to et cetera, et cetera. But it's also at the forefront of politics. Luke, why aren't you on TikTok?
Well, first off, yeah, hey, Alec, shout out to Brock and your family. It's cool that you're a listener. Hope they're all doing well. I agree with everything you say about TikTok being on the front lines of ideology. It's clearly very influential. As you note, tens of thousands of hours of engagement on Canadian politics TikTok with like very low effort going into it. You end by saying, I think a lot of people are dismissive of TikTok, thinking it is a teen dance video app, but it's definitely worth treating seriously. I agree with your premise, but I mean, as to your actual question, why aren't I on TikTok? Because, like, I mean, for the same reason that I'm like not really on, like, I don't use Instagram. I haven't used it for years. I don't have social media apps on my phone anymore, because I do just find the presence of those things in my life extremely distracting. And so I've made a conscious choice to kind of dial down my exposure to them. And TikTok, in a kind of panoply of addictive social media apps, I mean, I think it's the most addictive one of all. I had a friend who was staying with me a while back, and he'd actually downloaded it. And we just sat there for a few minutes with him scrolling. And like, I think it was the first time in my life that I felt my attention span erode completely. I felt like I was just being sucked into the vortex of this app. It was like that episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where they all get addicted to the game. And I feel like this won't make sense to anyone who hasn't seen the episode, but, you know, I feel like I have to be Will Wheaton as Wesley Crusher, and I have to just avoid the game so that I can be Gene Roddenberry's Mary Sue and, you know, save the day again.
I second everything that Luke says, and I would also just add that I already feel very spread thin as a content creator. I don't have anything to contribute to TikTok.
Now watch this drive.
Thanks, everyone. We'll be back with another Q&A very shortly, probably.
Yeah, not so late this time. Friends forever, we'll be together. We're on top 'cause we play to win.